Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
We're going to do this in 3, 2, and 1. Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Bruce Sedano has had his hand in some of the 20th century's biggest hits, sung by mega talents from Michael and Jermaine Jackson to Dolly Parton and Donna Summer, his late wife. At this point, he could easily rest on his musical laurels. Instead, he recorded an album about life right here, right now in the 21st century world. And he filled it with hard questions, some well-aimed finger-pointing, and poignant observations about the human experience, for better or worse. Sedano was 4 when he began making music, first on accordion, then on guitar and piano. He started getting paid 4 to 12. By the time he was 20, he had a hit, Ball of Fire, co-written with his mentor, Tommy James, who recorded it with the band The Shondells. Sedano had co-founded the band Alive and Kickin' in 1968. 1970, James wrote and produced their top 10 hit, Tighter and Tighter. 5 years after leaving that band, Sedano co-founded Brooklyn Dreams. That same year, in 1977, he met Summer, who began writing with the band. They penned Take It to the Zoo for Thank God It's Friday film soundtrack. Then the band appeared as the Planetones in the film American Hot Wax. They hit number 4 with Summer duetting on Heaven Knows. And in 1979, Summer and the band wrote the number 1 pop an R&B hit, Bad Girls, became the title song to the most popular album of her career. In 1980, Sedano released his first solo album, which contained Starting Over Again, written with Summer, about his parents' divorce. Dolly Parton turned it into a number one country hit. 15 years later, Reba McEntire took it to number 19. 1985, Sedano co-wrote the Grammy-nominated Michael and Jermaine Jackson duet, Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming, Too Good to Be True. After years spent managing Summer's career as well as playing and singing in her band, Sedano released another solo album, Rainy Day Soul. That 2004 release gave him 3 top 10 adult contemporary hits and New Music's Weekly Adult Contemporary Artist of the Year award. It's Her Wedding Day, a track from his 3rd solo album, earned him the 2009 New Music Weekly Adult Contemporary Song of the Year award. These days, you can find him performing alongside an eclectic group of musicians, from the widely successful band Johnny Swim to the iconic British band The Zombies, or jamming with young rockers Hollis Brown. Sedano is back on the road, re-engaging with his audiences. Please welcome multi-instrumentalist, singer, songwriter, Bruce Sedano to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Ray. I don't know what to say now. You basically said everything.
We're done.
That's it.
I tell you, man, I was a big fan, a very big fan, of your wife. Donna was wonderful. And, you know, I got caught up in the disco scene, I admit it. And I was a top 40 radio guy back in the late 70s, and I spun all her big hits when they first came out. So Yeah, man, we all loved her very much.
Yeah, Donna was the greatest.
She was the greatest. Yep, and you know, and you guys had a wonderful relationship, huh?
Yes, we did. We were married for 32 years.
Wow.
We raised three daughters. I now have, I just as of last week, have my ninth grandchild.
Oh, congratulations!
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Wow. That's huge. Yeah.
But yeah, see, but I don't want to send the wrong message because I'm still very creative and still out on the road and still discovering new aspects of my career and still have things that need to be said. And so that's where we are now.
Well, let me tell you, man, I love the new singles you've just released with him and In the Garden of November, which is, they're both, you know, beautiful tunes. And hats off to you on those songs.
Well, thanks, yeah. And the next one, I'll give you the big scoop. The next one that's coming out right after the first of the year is called The Mountain.
Right.
And it's more of an up-tempo jam, and it's also a really good one.
Now, that one, is that going to come out next year?
It'll come out after the first of the year, yes.
Okay, and now this is all from an EP, right, that you're going to be releasing?
Yeah, I'm releasing two EPs. You know, I'm trying to, you know, the culture of the day is, you know, you need to... stay in people's faces. So,
yeah.
You know, as opposed to releasing one LP with 10 songs on it or whatever, and, you know, that being the big splash, I've been, you know, I'm into this concept now where I'm releasing one song with a video, another song with a video, another song with a video. And with this third song, I will release the first part of the EP, which is called Story of Our Lives, Volume 1.
Right.
And then I will repeat the same concept right after that with another song with a video, another song video, and then the third song video with Stories of Our Lives, Volume 2, coming out probably sometime like June or like that. So, you know, I keep having a story to tell, and I kind of stay in the mix.
I tell you, I love your voice, you know? I mean, you know, you're kind of, you know, Brooklyn Dreams, you know, this is such a different style, I think, and your approach now to music, which I love a lot. It's really great, and your songwriting is incredible as well.
Yeah, well, you know, Brooklyn Dreams was, we were a trio.
Right.
And although I was, you know, maybe the main songwriter in that group and not the main singer.
Right.
You know, it was more R&B flavored. And of course, in that time, it was the disco time. And, you know, we got pulled into that genre a little bit more. Probably, but you know, even on the Brooklyn Dreams songs, there were always one or two songs on the albums that we did that were more or less more my style than the band. But the Brooklyn Dreams was known for, you know, its up-tempo, more R&B, dance kind of songs, and I certainly can write those and. You know, I still mix them into the mix every now and then. But now, you know, I'm in a phase of my career where I'm a solo artist,
right?
And I'm you know, writing and saying the things that are pertinent to just me, and I don't have to, you know. With Brooklyn Dreams, we were really trying to be a pop act in the moment.
Yeah,
you know, now I'm not playing that game anymore. I just want to write the best songs I can write and say the things that I want to say at this point in my life. And, you know, I'm still inspired and I'm still very creative and I'm still growing. So, it's interesting that I would find myself here at this point in my life, but it's
Yeah, you're a very emotional songwriter. I mean, the songs are very deep, you know. I mean, with him, you know, I mean, a lot of people have been there with those type of lyrics, I'm sure. And also in the Garden of November, man, they're incredible. You could be the next Dylan of our time. Who knows?
well, that's a stretch, Ray, but, you know, I appreciate the compliment.
I think it's incredible, you know. People don't write like this anymore, you know. And then, like you said, you know, I mean, you know, music today, I'm very, as an ex-DJ back in the top 40 days, I'm very disappointed with radio, terrestrial radio anyway. You know, the way, you know, it's a lot of girls, girl bands and things, not bands, but girl singers, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different time, and, you know, I'm a little bit old school, so
right.
I still, you know, feel I have to write a good song, and I spent, you know, I've developed my craft to this point, and so, but thank you. So,
I think it was cool that you hooked up with the Zombies. I know Colin, and you know, I've interviewed the Zombies and covered their shows and whatever. I love these guys, and I thought that was pretty cool. You went out and did some shows with them.
Yeah, no, they're great. I actually did a UK tour a few months ago with Colin.
Right.
And it was great. We had a great time. And now in April, I'm doing this Blue on the Blue cruise.
Awesome.
And after that, I'm doing another show with the Zombies. So that friendship and that musical hookup continues, and it's really been it's been a blessing to me, because, you know, in spite of all that I've done and the length of my career,
right,
you know, as a singer, songwriter, performer, you know, I'm really not known. So when I open for these other bands, it really gives me an opportunity to have an audience. And you know, what's interesting is that as I tell my story during the show, during the course of my songs, it turns out that it is very engaging for the audience, and they really like it. And so it's working, and you know, even at this point in my career, I'm building an audience in a different way.
Yeah, I think you're going to have a lot of success. I really do. With this, it's a new age for you now. It's a new beginning, basically, like you said, which is pretty cool.
You know, and it's really interesting to, you know, like, what is success in these days in the music world?
Right.
You know, I mean, success for me actually is, you know, writing a great song and having somebody like you appreciate it. You know, that success, and going out there and singing these songs live, which, you know, brings the songs to life.
Yeah.
You know, and to get the response of an audience, and you know, to touch them, and to have them say, you know, I relate to that. That was my story too.
Right.
And you know, I've really started going out touring again, but on my own, since Donna has passed away.
Yeah.
So that's been 7 years now.
Right.
So it's been an interesting journey, and but as I said earlier, I'm really enjoying it, and I'm having a good time, and I'm still growing. So
yeah, exactly.
Who knew?
Who knew? You know, there's a lot of musicians, especially legendary guys, that are really trying to find themselves again. You know, they're guys that were in bands for years, and now they're solo, and they're taking it to a whole new direction, just like you are. So it's, I think it's great, you know?
Yeah.
And you're the type of guy,
totally.
You're the type of guy who can play anything and do anything, really.
Yeah, well, same reason.
Well, another guy I know who I've interviewed several times, great guy, Tommy James. And he's a good friend of yours as well. And you guys, he wrote a song for you. You wrote a song with him. You still talk to Tommy?
The last time I saw Tommy was about a year ago. I was playing at the Cutting Room in New York.
Yep.
And he came to the show. And, you know, I refer to him as my mentor because, you know, he was the first guy who really took me under his wing and involved me in the writing of a pop song, took me into a recording studio, you know, and let me witness how, you know, a record was made. And so it was very... inspirational and foundational in my career, and he's a super talented guy. Yep. I think he's very underrated, and I'm forever grateful to him. You know, so
that's another great story. You know how they found Hanky Panky in a bin, and they started playing it, and that whole thing. You know,
yes.
And you guys in your band Alive and Kicking, and he wrote Tighter, great song, by the way. That's a song that goes down in, you know, 60s, you know, history, really. I mean, every time you hear it.
You know, basically what happened was Alive and Kicking was the house band at this club in the city. And it was called the Cheetah. And it was basically right around the corner from Tommy's apartment. And on breaks, you know, in between sets, I would run over there frequently with Woody Wilson, the bass player, and we would write with Tommy on the breaks.
Right.
And then, you know, run back to the club, do the next set, and then, you know, he always recorded at Allegro Studio, which was on 51st Street. And then, you know, we started going to the studio and saw him put together these, you know, great records, Crimson and Clover and Crystal Blue Persuasion and, you know, like that. So it was a great time. It was a very exciting time. It was, for me, a formative time.
Were you guys supposed to get Crystal Blue Persuasion originally, and he decided to keep it?
Yeah, that's the way it went. You know, in those days, you know, they didn't always take a second song off an album,
right?
But in this case, he had Crimson and Clover and. Morris Levy, the head of the company, decided that Crystal Blue Persuasion was going to be his follow-up single. And you know, we were kind of disappointed because we were so excited to, you know, have a record deal and to actually even make a real record. And we had rehearsed the song. But then we got the call and Morris basically said, "Don't worry, kids. I'll have them write you another one." You know, and sure enough, I don't exactly remember how long later, you know, but it was a little bit of time later, maybe a couple of months later. Tommy came through with Tighter and Tighter, and we went in and cut it. And Morris was true to his word, and next thing we knew, we had a song on the radio.
Interesting character, huh, Morris Levy?
Yeah, you know, he's infamous for sure.
Oh yeah.
But also a great guy,
right?
So, you know, a great character and a great record man. Had good ears. It's the same thing. You know, in a different way with Casablanca and Neil Bogart. You know,
right,
they always tend to talk about Casablanca and, oh, it was always a party. party, and there was all these drugs, and, you know, and that's really not the story. The story is this guy, you know, and Neil Bogart was a visionary who, mm-hmm. you know, who, you know, could take something and would find a way to break it, and he was a believer, and if he believed, you know, there was no mountain too high for him. So, you know, these were great record men.
Yep.
Who, yeah, there was a side story, but that, you know, the side story is the side story. The main story is that they were great record men who had great ears and knew a hit record and knew how to put the pieces together and, you know, knew how to break a record. So I was fortunate to be, you know, involved with both those guys.
There's a video that, I don't know, I think it was an interview or something that Frank Zappa did, and Zappa was saying the guys like Levy and the old guys chomping on cigars, those are the guys that gave you a break in the music industry, you know? And it was the guys that, the young guys who thought they knew everything, those are the guys you had to watch out for, because those are the idiots, you know, in the music industry. And he was right. Like, he was right, you know?
Yeah.
They would take a chance on you, you know?
You know, it's certainly my story is that, you know, Morris and Neil both took a chance on me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and Neil brought us Kiss, you know? I guess he introduced the world to Kiss. And, you know.
Yeah, no, Kiss, the Village People,
yeah.
You know, and of course Donna.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
So,
yeah. Like you said,
not your typical run of the mill, you know, acts. They
right.
were all a little bit different, and all needed to be worked a little bit differently. And you know, but he, like I said, he was a believer, and he found a way to do it. But it always comes back down to the music. So you know, the music had to be great. You know, he had to hear a hit. And
but, yeah, well, that's it. They knew, when they heard it, they knew it was going to be a hit. You know, people can't. You know, it was. That's a gift. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, but that's not to say. You know, I mean, with Love to Love You, Baby, he found a way. You know, they wouldn't play it on the radio,
right.
And he found a way to. You know, he went to Frankie Crocker and said, "Play it." All night, you know, just play it at night.
Yeah,
you know, and once that started, you know, people started listening to it, started requesting it,
yeah.
And then before you know it, they were playing it during the day, and then it became a hit.
Yeah.
So, like I said, you know, there was always, you know, a twist.
I guess that was a little risque, you know, that song, and also Pillow Talk, you know, by Sylvia. That was another risque
yes.
tune, you know, but,
yeah.
you know.
Well, for those days, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I played the hell when I was in Top 40, man. I played, you know, Donna Summer was, I mean, she was coming out with hits after hits after hits, and you were a big part of that team, you know, as a songwriter, which was, you know, you guys were a fantastic duo.
Yeah, we, you know, when I met Donna, that was the first thing we started doing. You know, that was the initial inception of our relationship, was we started writing songs together. And we had a very similar background. We
mm-hmm.
had very similar likes in the acts that we liked, the influences that we had. And so when we would get together, it was very easy. And, you know, and Donna was a great songwriter. You know, she had great ideas and was very lyrical and had great melodies. And you know, people don't always recognize her as the songwriter that she was.
Right.
But
right.
she was a great songwriter. And, you know, co-wrote most of her hit songs.
especially Bad Girls. I mean, that, you know, I that was probably my favorite song, just because I was in, you know, back in 79, I was working Top 40 in Annapolis, Maryland, you know, and when that song hit.
Yeah. You know, Bad Girls was, you know, it was an idea that Donna had for a while, and it kind of referred to, you know, there was this issue going on. Casablanca was on Sunset Boulevard, and there was this place called the Body Shop across the way. And so there were frequently ladies of the night walking up and down the street, and there was always this problem where the girls from Casablanca who worked at Casablanca would go out, and, you know, people would, you know, misinterpret them for ladies of the night. And so this was, you know, the initial idea, and you know, Donna kept saying, I want to write this song about this, you know, and then initially Joe Esposito, Eddie Hogenson, and myself, who were the my partners in the Brooklyn Dreams, we went into a studio with Donna, which was called Magic Wand, which was also run by another friend of ours from Brooklyn whose name was Bobby and Corbia. And we would just set up mics, and you know, I play Bad Girls in my show, and what I tell the audience is that, you know, Bad Girls was a big dance hit, it was a big R&B hit, it was a big pop hit, but this is how the song was written. It was written on an acoustic guitar. And that's kind of how we wrote it, you know, and Donna had that idea, and Donna was a very stream of conscious songwriter. You know, she liked to turn on the mic, turn on the tape recorder, and let's just roll and see what comes out. And that's kind of how it was with Bad Girls. And frequently, my role in writing with Donna, in when it was that kind of situation, would be to, you know, go back and you know, kind of put the puzzle together, and where the puzzle didn't fit, find a way to make it fit. And if there was a line that was needed, you know, find the right line. And that was kind of the case with that song. So,
Yeah, I heard you do that acoustically on YouTube, you know, and it sounds it sounds great either way, to be honest with you. You know?
Yeah, no, it definitely does. Well, you know, that's the other thing, is that we always would do this thing. When Don and I were writing a song, frequently we had, you know, had to write up-tempo songs. But what we would like to do was slow the song down and do it as a ballad. And because frequently, if you slow a song down and do it as a ballad, you can really tell, you know, if the song is working, if the melody is strong enough, if the lyrics are strong enough, you know, it's like putting it under a microscope. So, you know, when you write a good song, it basically can work anyway, any way you do it, because it's a good song, and the melody and lyric will hold up.
Now, was it you and Brooklyn Dreams who turned it into that disco, the disco beat after that, after it was on acoustic, or how did that work?
Well, it was kind of up-tempo as we wrote it. You know, I always tell the story that back then we were listening to the Isley Brothers a lot. You know, and there's another, and there's also a song on the Brooklyn Dreams album that I wrote called Street Dance. And Street Dance was, you know, kind of a precursor to Bad Girls, and that it was a similar chord structure, and it was a blending of R&B and rock and disco. So, you know, that's kind of how we heard it. Even though we wrote it on acoustic guitar, you know, in production, that's how we heard it.
A song you wrote, too, was I'm a Rainbow. What happened with that? It wasn't released when it was supposed to be released. Is that right?
Yeah, that was the last song that Donna did. That was the last album that Donna did for Casablanca. And when the album got turned in, they weren't Rainbow is a song that I wrote. I think it's one of the best songs that I've ever written, you know, and it's really one of those songs that you write that comes out of nowhere. You don't, you know, you just, you know, I just sat down at the piano.
Yeah.
And it's not a typical song for me. It's very atypical of a song, kind of song that I would write, but it just flowed right out of me. Mm-hmm. And, and Donald loved it and recorded it for that record, and then ended up calling that album Mama Rainbow, all of which was a surprise for me. But
is I'm a Rainbow, is that in your act, in your show, or no?
I haven't done it yet. You know, I typically always want to do new songs when I'm performing, you know, so sometimes I'll do Bad Girl, sometimes I'll do Starting Over Again, but you know, as a songwriter, you're always in love with your newer thing. So I haven't done I'm a Rainbow yet, but, you know, I'm sure I will do it one day.
Yeah, maybe you can revive it a little bit more, you know, and, you know,
yeah. I mean,
especially if you're that proud of it, you know, I would.
Yeah.
Starting Over Again, that song carried a lot of weight, because, you know, you did it with Donna. I guess it was about, was it your parents' divorce, I guess? And
my parents were getting divorced, and I started writing this song. We were living in L.A. in Hancock Park, and I had this little room in the back of the house with a Fender Rhodes, and I was back there writing this song. And at some point, Donna stuck her head in the door, opened the door, and said, "You know, you should put a line in that song, 'All the King's Horses and All the King's Men.'" And I said, "Okay," and so I finished writing the song, and it was just, you know, another song that I had written, and Donna one day was getting ready to go on The Tonight Show to sing her new single, which I think at that time was MacArthur Park.
Okay.
And she comes to me and she says, "You know what? I'm gonna sing Starting Over Again tonight on The Tonight Show." And I was like, you know, that's really beautiful that you want to do that, but you know, you have a new single, and that's why you're going on the show, and blah, blah, blah. And she says, "I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway." And I'm like, "Well, why do you want to do that?" And she said, "Because maybe if I do, your parents will stay together."
Oh, how sweet is that?
Yeah, exactly. So she goes on The Tonight Show and sings Starting, you know, Donna never actually recorded Starting Over Again.
Right.
You know, so she goes on The Tonight Show, sings the song, and literally the next day, Dolly Parton's people call inquiring about the song, and that's how it ended up that Dolly sang the song. So when I perform that song live, I say to the audience, if any of you are songwriters out there and want to know how to get a song cut, just have your wife sing it on The Tonight Show.
That's a great story, man.
Yeah.
And Dolly made it was a number one hit for her, right?
It was a number one country song for Dolly, yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. And then Reba did it later. She recorded it, I think, in 95 or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
It didn't go to number one again, but it did do well. And it was also the title of Reba's album.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, you're a great songwriter, man.
You know, this is how things happen, you know. You just, you know, my philosophy is you do what you do.
Yep.
And, keep going, and you know, frequently you think, "Oh, there it is, right in front of me. This is where I'm going. This is what's going to happen." And you know, that's not the way it happens. It comes out of left field, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
talking. Yeah.
You have to show up and, you know, keep doing the work.
Keep doing the work, yeah. And, you know, it's very lucrative to be a songwriter. I mean, you know, it's great to have a hit, but if you didn't write the song, it's not the same. You know?
Yeah, well, yep. It is, especially if you're able to hold on to your publishing or have a co-publishing situation.
Exactly.
You know, I've done a bunch of shows with Dan Navarro recently.
Yeah.
And Dan is a singer-songwriter, and but he wrote a song called "We Belong" that Pat Benatar made a big hit out of.
Right.
And so he always had his songwriting share, but didn't have a publishing share until right now, because after a certain amount of years, your publishing will revert back to the songwriter. So
right.
He was just telling me recently that he was very excited because he was getting his publishing back, and that's a big deal for a songwriter.
It is a big deal, you know, and people think it's easy, but it's not. Sometimes you got to fight your way to, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, that was one of the first things that when I met Donna that I made her aware of was, you know, because of the experience that I had previously with Morris and Big Seven Publishing and that whole scenario, I had learned early on the value of publishing.
Yeah.
And so when I met Donna, she didn't have her publishing.
Right.
And I said, you know, I explained to her that she needed to get her publishing back, and because she was in such a position of power at that time because of the great success that she was having, she was able to negotiate her publishing back. So still to this day, you know, my family enjoys the benefit of all the publishing that, from Donna's catalog.
That's incredible. That is so important. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yep.
You remember when Michael Jackson bought a lot of the Beatles stuff? I mean, I was like, what?
Yeah.
But I think Paul
I sure do.
Yeah, I think Paul got a lot of that back eventually, you know.
I hope so.
And I, you know, Tommy James, that's another story, you know. It took him a long time to get credit for a lot of stuff that I guess Morris didn't pay him for, you know?
Yeah. You know, Morris was funny that way. You know, I remember having, like, you know, the top 10, you know, song in the country, and we were touring all around, and, you know, I would basically go to Morris and say, Morris, the song is, you know, in the top 10.
Right.
You know, we need to buy a new sound system because we're going on tour.
Yeah.
You know, and Hebert, all right, kid, you know, and he would, you know, basically give me $1,500 cash and send me out of his office. you know, till this day, I don't think I get any royalties for Tider.
Really?
I don't. You know, and very little for Ball of Fire as well.
Really?
But those songs, you know, yeah. I mean, Tider I didn't write, but Ball of Fire,
right?
I never did get the publishing back for that.
Really? You got to talk to Tommy about that. Didn't you? Did you co-write that with Tommy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, give him a call.
Yeah, I will.
Definitely. And you wrote some music for Michael Jackson and Jermaine with "Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming." You wrote for them.
Yeah, well, yeah. The story on that goes like this: my friend Michael Abardian was producing Jermaine,
right?
And he asked me, you know, in those days, this was in the '80s. You know, one of the best ways for a songwriter to get a cut on the album was to work with the producer, because frequently in those days, the producer was also a big part of Michael was a friend of mine. I had worked with him on a couple of Donna's albums where I co-wrote songs.
Mm-hmm.
And so he invited me to come in and co-write some songs on the Jermaine mm-hmm. album.
Right.
And I think I co-wrote four songs on that album. And one of them was Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming, which wasn't originally conceived as a duet. But then when Michael heard the song, he loved the song. And he asked if he could sing on it. Mm-hmm. And of course, we were like, yeah. please do. But subsequently what happened was that the song was released. Jermaine and Michael were on different labels.
Right.
And so Jermaine was on Arista, and the record came out and started flying up the charts, and then Columbia or Epic, which was Michael, I think it was Epic, was Michael's label. They said, "Whoa, wait a minute, you can't do that," and so they basically, you know, put the brakes on it. So that song never really reached its full potential because. Yeah. You know, Epic put the brakes on the song. I mean, even though it did, you know, it did do, I think it went number one in the club charts and
did
well on the R&B chart, but it didn't, pop-wise, it didn't go as high as it could because of that issue.
Are you still writing for other artists, or you know, presenting them with new ideas or anything like that?
These days, I really haven't.
Uh-huh.
I've really been focusing on my solo work, and that's not to say that if an artist found one of my songs or wanted to co-write, I would. But I'm really focused on what I have to say and where I want to go as a solo artist.
Mm-hmm.
So that hasn't happened in a while.
Right.
And I haven't even been co-writing in the last number of years as mm-hmm. well. I lived in Nashville for a number of years.
Right.
Although, you know, I've had great success collaborating,
mm-hmm.
there came a time when I was in Nashville where I got very frustrated with it because I felt that I wasn't doing my best work because of compromises that you would have to make. And because in Nashville, they tend to... You know, these songwriters will do two or three sessions a day.
Right.
And it takes me longer to get down to the soul of a song.
Right, right.
So these days I've been writing by myself, and if the right situation turns up, I'm sure I'd be co-writing again.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're doing the right thing. I mean, I think you're going to come up with more brilliant songwriting ideas on your own, you know, than hanging out in Nashville.
Yeah, well, I anticipate there will come a day when I get to the end of myself.
Right.
And I've been through this cycle many times, in my career.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you kind of get to the end of yourself, and then it's good to co-write because... You know, you get a little, it opens another door, it sparks another flame,
mm-hmm.
Creatively, it's a good thing to do. So, I've had a really good run these last number of years, so far so good, but I'm sure the day will come where I'll be like, I need some outside input here.
Right. Hey, that's a good title for a song, Getting to the End of Myself. I like that. That's kind of...
Yeah.
You know?
All right. There you go. Maybe the next co-writer is with you.
There you go. I wanted to ask you, are you involved at all with the Donna Summer musical?
Yes, I am.
Okay, yeah, that's a big success, and it's actually coming to Tampa in May of next year. So I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yep, I was the one who, sparked that situation.
Right.
Saw it through its inception and, the writing of it and the whole thing. So dealing with Broadway and Broadway people was a whole other experience. So it was a whole new experience for me.
Yeah.
Quite different than I was used to.
Right.
There were, many compromises that I had to make that frustrated me. We got the show done. We got it on Broadway.
Yeah.
People are loving it.
Yeah.
And who am I to say what right is? I'm just so happy that that was able to happen. Another part of my life is spent in maintaining Donna's credibility and
right.
her visibility
right.
and out in the world.
Right.
And a Broadway musical was the top of my list.
Yep, I agree with
and, you.
And
it's a very difficult thing to have to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just grateful that I was able to do it with the help of, a lot of people.
Yeah.
And now the next thing that we're going to be doing is a documentary.
Oh, man. Great.
I just actually 2 days ago signed a deal with Universal.
Right.
To produce the documentary, which hopefully we're going to be starting filming right after the first of the year.
Fantastic.
So
I'm
hopeful with the documentary to bring another aspect of Donna, of who she was and how she created and how she lived and what she believed. I think in a documentary you can go deeper than you can in a musical. The musical, has all her hits, and it basically tells her life story.
Yep.
But it can only go so deep because there's only so much time.
Right.
So with the documentary, I'm sure, I'm hopeful that we're going to bring another element to the Donna Summer story.
I love documentaries and bios. I mean, that's all I do. I'm on there watching all those about musicians and artists and things like that. I mean, it's wonderful.
Yep.
I love it. I do have to. I got to ask you. You don't have to answer if you don't want to. But I know Donna passed away with lung cancer, and I heard she didn't smoke at all. Is that true?
Yeah, she really didn't smoke. I mean, there was a moment of time in her life where, she smoked a little bit. It was a very short period of time.
Right.
The truth of that is nobody knows how or nobody knows why. There's nowhere real, frequently there's no real answer for these, why you get these diseases.
Very strange.
Sometimes there are, but frequently there's not. There's no rhyme or reason. So, we really don't know.
Yeah. I know it was mentioned that she was at the 911 site at one time, and they might have thought, because people have.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hypothesis.
Right.
I've seen it out there and read it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows?
Yeah, who knows is right. Yeah, I know. It's very tough. My sister-in-law died of cancer. It came out of nowhere, and I'm actually waiting for results on the test for me, and I'm a little nervous.
Really?
Yeah.
that'll make you nervous.
It is making me nervous. Like you said, though, it comes out of nowhere. I mean, I'm not a smoker, you know. So, yeah. I don't know. It just happens. But here's your final question, Bruce. And I ask a lot of lot of people the same question. I get a lot of interesting answers. If you have had a Field of Dreams wish, you know, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Well, you know, my favorite songwriter is Bob Dylan.
Right.
So, you know, whenever I get asked that question, you know, that's my fallback answer.
Yep.
You know, but, you know, it's really a fantasy and one of improbability. It's not one that I ever expect to happen. But if I had to have a dream of that question, that would be it. I mean, that's a short answer to probably a question that you wanted a more elaborate answer to.
Not really. not really. Have you ever met Bob Dylan?
Have I ever what?
Have you ever met Bob Dylan?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Nope, never have. And, but, you know, life is full of surprises, so you never know.
Bruce, I want to thank you so much, man, for being on the call today. I hope to see you know, back in Florida. I know you used to have a house here, and was it Englewood, maybe, or did you have a house in Florida?
We had a house in Manasota Key.
Manasota Key, yeah, not too far from me. Yeah,
not too far from Sarasota, and we also had a place in Naples.
Oh, really? So, oh, cool.
Yeah,
very cool. So you know the area.
Yeah.
So
thanks, Ray.
Thank you, man. Hope to see you on the road. And happy holidays to you.
Yep, and I hope everything turns out well with you.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Bruce.
Be blessed.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
For more information about Bruce Sedano and to purchase his new singles, visit www.brucesedano.com and also www.facebook.com/Bruce Sedano Music. Also, www.thedonnasummermusical.com to find out where the Donna Summer Musical is playing in your town. And also, Donna Summer's official site is at www.donnasummer.com. Very special thanks to Fiona Bloom for arranging this interview with Bruce Sedano, and of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsom of BBS Radio for making the magic for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. And it's real news, people. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of a Neglected American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody, and happy holidays.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.